Now here's your host, Michael Corbin.
And good evening and welcome to the program. Tonight, we're going to have a very interesting and special guest. It's Richard Hoagland. He's going to be talking to us from Windsor, Colorado tonight, where he is giving a lecture, has done so since yesterday. He's been talking about the JFK-NASA connection vis-a-vis the moon, secret societies, and the private mission to the moon that he is planning and orchestrating and coordinating. We're going to talk about that tonight in the hour. And we're going to talk about free energy, something that Richard's been working on as well, and we're going to update you on that. On to my guest. Richard Hoagland is a former NASA consultant and CBS News science advisor to Walter Cronkite during the historic Apollo missions to the moon. He is now, like I said before, he's in Fort Collins, or a town called Windsor, which is just east of Fort Collins. He is being sponsored by a group called Integrity Incorporated, and Richard has kindly granted us the interview tonight on the program to talk about a little bit of what he's been investigating. So with that, I welcome Richard Hoagland, and good evening, Richard.
Good evening, Mike.
Thank you for being on the program.
It's nice to be back on.
What? Tell us a little bit about the JFK-NASA connection that you're talking about up there in Windsor.
Well, that kind of is beginning at the end of the story. I think it would probably be more appropriate to describe a little bit of how we got here.
Okay.
This is the first of a series of workshops that the Mars mission and our multidisciplinary team are now doing around the country. This was a bit of an experiment. We selected rather carefully to begin this here in the heartland of America, and it was quite serendipitous that the folks at Integrity, Edie Riesenhuber and Nancy O'Brien, turned out to be our hostesses for the first of these. We've had a two-day session with upwards of 30, 40 people. And this actually represents a break. We're going to be concluding this evening when we go off the air from 8 to probably 10 or 10:30 out under the moonlight with the final session of this two-day workshop, which is really an overview of where the Mars mission research has come from, a lot of the data that we've acquired in looking at these images from NASA, beginning with Mars and now looking carefully at the moon, the conclusions we have been able to draw from the physics that have been decoded. You may or may not know, Michael, that in 93, a couple of years ago, the Angstrom Foundation from Stockholm, Sweden, flew to Washington to present me with the Angstrom Medal for Excellence in Science for the physics discovered vis-a-vis the monuments of Mars. And it is this hyperdimensional physics which is terribly important and at the heart of an extraordinary series of potential opportunities for the human family, not the least of which is the so-called free energy field, which we feel very strongly now is based, in fact, on practical application of this hyperdimensional physics. So the last 2 days has been a discussion of a wide range of topic areas where the Mars mission research team and some of its data now seems particularly relevant, up to and including, what was the real agenda behind the Apollo missions to the moon, who is standing in the way as impediments to, general public knowledge of what we found, and where do we go from here in terms of applying this specific physics to intervening in some of the serious geological problems that we are now foreseeing, along with many others, that are coming in the years ahead, because it's very important to know that because of this physics, it is our position that there are interventions that science can make in terms of the so-called earth changes that people are glibly throwing around and many do not understand how they may or may not be averted.
Okay, let's start off with some brief history on this stuff, and the Apollo mission is the thing that fascinates me the most.
Well, again, at the risk of interrupting, I think people need to see a segue. The Mars mission is a loose confederation of scientists and laypersons and multidisciplinary experts in a variety of fields. And I founded it about 12 years ago as I began looking at this NASA data from Mars, which consisted of the Viking photographs of the Cydonia region, uh-huh, on which the so-called face on Mars and the related structures first appeared. We have been carefully looking with a variety of top talent, Torin at DMA and Carlotto at TASC and others around the country and even overseas at this data, and it has deepened and matured, and we now very firmly believe that, A, there are ruins, ancient ruins on Mars of some considerable extent, They're roughly 300,000 to 200,000 years in age. They are arrayed in a rather striking geometric configuration. That geometry is intended to, A, tell us that the structures are real because they're self-referential. The complex knows its location on the planet, and that's part of what our work is now, you know, determined. It also, in terms of geometry and mathematics, was designed to communicate a specific set of mathematical constants, and it is those constants which form the basis of what we are terming the rediscovery of hyperdimensional physics, which is literally, I mean, and Michael, this is very appropriate for your show, it's a physics of other dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
It's a paraphysics, if you will. And actually, this is a physics which seems to have implications in fields as far apart as free energy, the control of gravity, the relationship of energy sources, of the stars, of the planets, you know, motions of material in the galaxy, formations of solar systems, how energy comes up in worlds, moving all the way through to biological implications, the appearance and disappearance of species on this planet over geologic and shorter periods of time, the appearance of major terrestrial, volcanic, and geological changes in very brief periods of time with concomitant risk for, you know, human civilizations which are precariously perched atop a very fragile terrestrial crust. And then finally, the potential for explaining in terms of a real, demonstrable, predictable physics, the continuum of consciousness itself, which includes such things as clairvoyance, precognition, telepathy, the so-called parasciences, all right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a heck of a broad spectrum.
Sure is.
For a physics to challenge. And the neat thing is that I can demonstrate, if we had, you know, hours and hours that we've been doing through these 2 days of these workshops, areas of specific, you know, confirmation of each of these subcategories in terms of the data that we now have at our disposal.
Okay, and so essentially what we're dealing with then here is a new type of physics.
No, it's a very old type of physics.
Okay.
100 years ago, we somehow got off the rails, Mike. James Clerk Maxwell and a whole bunch of other scientists, you know, in the last century were starting us down the path, which if it had continued uninterrupted, we would now be flying around in anti-gravity vehicles. We would be lighting our homes and our cities with small, transportable, democratizable power sources, no big grids, no fossil fuels, no oil lamps, no nothing. We would be communicating to each other across thousands or millions of miles because we would have flourishing advanced spaceflight and we would be exploring the Magellanic Clouds. All right, we'd be doing it via hyperdimensional telepathy, so there'd be instant, no time lag, no speed of light. You know, instead, look where we are tonight on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
We're warring with each other, we're fighting with each other, we're killing each other, and we're on the precipice of major geological changes, and most of us are not even aware that these, in fact, are predictable, recur, and can be counteracted by application of this physics, and we're 100 years behind where we should have been if something had not happened.
Okay, now how do we get derailed, as you put it?
That's a very good question. And we can either pick the dumbness model or the deception model. We can pick the fact that, you know, in dealing with human affairs, people many times are not infallible. In fact, they're not even, you know, close to being infallible.
Right.
They pick many wrong options. Unfortunately, because as our survey of data has increased and as our expertise has increased with the acquisition of other members of this loose confederation, and I'm talking about anthropologists, scientific historians, philosophers of science, you know, lots of very, very high-level, world-class people. People like Richard Thompson, for instance. Do you know Richard Thompson?
Yes, I do.
Forbidden Archaeology?
Uh-huh.
All you have to do is read his 25-pound doorstop, which is an extraordinary compendium of all the misinformation and misdirection in the field of human evolution. And you quickly discover that all of those folks were not wrong. They were misdirected. There was a systematic, conscious effort by a variety of institutions and even individuals, both in government and in key positions of responsibility in science, to consistently mislead the rest of academics, students, and the general population in terms of the evidence of our own origins and heritage. Two-thirds of the evidence in museums and archives on human heritage now does not support the current prevailing evolutionary model. But it's suppressed. It's sat upon. It's not put on display. It is misrepresented. Well, what we have found, and I didn't really understand this until I talked with Thompson and Cremo over dinner one night, is that this same subversion, this same misdirection, apparently has also been occurring in a wide variety of other scientific fields. It's almost, Michael, as if somebody has been trying to throttle and suppress the development of the human species at this crucial moment in solar system time.
That's very interesting, too, because I think you find a lot of evidence in that regarding other subjects, too, that we study in the paranormal. Some people would argue that there is definitely a directed effort to suppress this information because it would be contrary to economic control.
Well, the economic factors are only one potential reason. I'm beginning to think that the real causative factors and agendas and motives are even broader. Because if we're right, if this rediscovery, and I want to emphasize that we are claiming that we are rediscovering a physics that not only is at least 100 years old with James Maxwell, but in fact is probably hundreds of thousands, if not millions of years old, and I base that, of course, on the evidence in the artifacts on Mars, and later we found the same evidence in the structures on the Moon. Somebody living in the solar system at an extraordinary high-tech and connected level not only knew this physics, operated according to this physics, had a whole culture and civilization built around this physics, but they left us overwhelming clues so that we who would come after could pick up the pieces and move on.
And last break, we talked about they, and I would like to expand on that, Richard. When you talk about they, who is that you're referring to?
Well, you know, our research, remember, is based on hopefully a sound methodological analysis of the NASA data indicating that there has been extensive prior habitation of other bodies, planetary objects in the solar system. We began looking at Mars. We now have this robust, very, very, you know, compelling evidence that the structures of Cydonia and possibly other places on Mars exist. We then moved our investigation a couple, 3 years ago to the Moon, and we found the most remarkable evidence, which, by the way, has just been all published in the latest journal issue of Martian Horizons. This is our Mars mission journal that we publish hopefully four times a year. The last issue is 80 pages long. That's 80 pages long. It contains page after page after page of carefully enlarged, enhanced, and laid out imagery from the Moon. And I strongly recommend to anyone interested that you subscribe to the journal. You send us a check for $25 for four issues to Martian Horizons, the Mars Mission, 122 Dodd Street, Weehawken, New Jersey, 07087. And this will give you a very good handle on the lunar database that we've now added to our Martian inquiry over the last 12 years. With that as a background, with little doubt that we're looking at lots and lots of architecture, very ancient, then the question has to be raised, who built it, Michael?
Sure, absolutely. You've
got to confront who was out there. We are of the developing opinion, all right, that we're looking at our own stuff. We're looking at the hidden history of the human race, as Cremo and Thompson have determined it, except it is such an extraordinary and stunningly bigger history than anybody has dared imagine. And it is a history that literally NASA is quite frankly hidden from all the rest of us for over 30 years. There is no doubt now in my mind that NASA has known in very high levels, not widespread with the NASA, but by a select few, that were in the positions of policy, of directing the astronauts to go to the Moon, the astronauts themselves undoubtedly key photographic experts, key geologists, that there has been a core group within the agency that has known that this would knock our socks off and radically revise our perspective of who we are and where we have come from, and that is specifically why we have not been told.
Now, Richard, what is the evidence of the cover-up that you're referring to? What is the evidence of that? I mean,
well, there's a very important set of evidence, and again, this is, you know, this 80-page journal, I not only deal, you know, in terms of the evidence, the photographic evidence, mm-hmm. but we also discuss things like, and there's a whole article devoted to why we and the Soviets have gone nowhere near the moon for the last 30 years.
Which is true, we haven't.
Mm-hmm. The first mission back to the moon
was Clementine.
Since NASA was a Pentagon mission. The Ballistic Missile Defense Organization, the SDI folks, sent Clementine, 500-pound unmanned Clementine rocket or spacecraft, loaded with all kinds of sensors, to map the moon to acquire almost 2 million images, which they have sat on now for over a year.
What is their motive for that? What was the motive for that mission? Was it to...
Well, again, you're asking me speculative questions. You know, the generals and the admirals don't kind of call me up and say, okay, Hoagland, this is what we're doing and this is why we're doing it. I mean, your guess is as good as mine. But like the O.J. trial, what we have here is a stunning case of circumstantial evidence.
Mm-hmm.
If O.J. is convicted on circumstantial evidence, I've got enough evidence on NASA and the DOD to convict them 10 times over.
Well, I've always wondered, too, if there was any other reason behind firing Richard Truly several years ago.
That's a very good question, Michael. I have suspicion that Truly's firing was somehow linked to the public disclosure and airing of the STS-48 video. Do you remember the video that Don Ecker showed on Larry King?
Right, uh-huh.
On, I guess it was, not on Solved Mysteries, but Current Affairs.
Now, this was the video that showed the object that appeared to be coming into frame.
More than one object. There are a plethora of objects. We now, by the way, have first-generation video from key NASA sources in Houston. We finally, after all these years, acquired an exquisite first-generation copy, and shortly after we go off the air, I'm going to be showing it to our workshop participants here in Windsor, Colorado.
That's a very interesting video.
It basically was acquired from the shuttle with the television cameras in the payload bay, looking at the horizon over the northern part of Australia, the northwestern deserts of Australia, and you see a remarkable plethora of objects brilliantly glowing, dashing about, exceeding all normal rocket propulsion capabilities, and then zipping off into space with something firing at them from below the shuttle in terms of objects coming up out of the atmosphere. And there are many more objects and a lot more, shall we say, firings of some kind of weapon system, all taking place just before dawn from the shuttle, looking backward as it looked back toward night from where it had just come.
I think we ought to mention, too, that the official explanation of that was ice.
Well, but Jack Kasher, who's a physicist at the University of Nebraska, has done an extremely complex and sophisticated analysis to dovetail with our own, which has been published as the last half hour of the second briefing video, the UN video that I did as part of a briefing at the UN a couple of years ago, and that Mark Carlotto participated in. And Kasher's independent analysis based on engineering data from the thrusters, from the onboard fuel system, from a variety of engineering NASA data, is there is no possible way that one can explain away these objects as little pieces of ice floating around next to the shuttle, pushed around by steering jets on the shuttle, as James Oberg would have us all blithely believe.
Right.
That simply is not valid. It is an untruth, and is an untruth that no engineer worthy of his salt would ever perpetuate.
Now, just for the audience, too, I should mention that Richard Truly was the former director of NASA.
He actually was one of the astronauts who flew the Enterprise.
And he was let go in 93, wasn't it?
Say again?
Was he let go in 93?
No, he was let go in the late 80s, in fact, just before the last election. He was fired by Dan Quayle.
Right, he was replaced by a guy from TRW named Dan Golden.
Dan Golden.
Who we know is...
Turns out to have had about 30 years of experience with black projects.
Right, and that's
Dan Golden knows how to keep secrets.
And you know, the thing is, a lot of this could tie into the Star Wars and all the SDI stuff.
Well, again, it could be, would be, maybe. The fact is that Truly was fired right after STS-48 video came to light.
Mm-hmm.
And it also came to light at the same time out of the NASA Lewis Research Center that there was a memo from the director's office instructing NASA employees how to lie, cheat, and steal on FOIA requests from the public, from the press, and from the Congress. FOIA is Freedom of Information Act. Truly, when he found out about this memo, that was an official memo from a NASA center, hit the ceiling. He went ballistic. He promised everyone he would launch a major investigation, and it was right on the heels of that and STS-48 that Dan Quayle suddenly fired him.
Richard, when we went to break, we were talking about NASA, and one of the things I wanted to ask you this about is I have found in my own research that there appears to have been at least some concern on the part of NASA that there might be something out there, referring to what you're talking about, the discovery of these architectures on the Moon and Mars, they go back several years, actually.
Well, if we can believe now NASA's own documentation, this is mission documents, flight plans, mission SPs, those are special publications, catalogs of photography. The deception began very shortly after the first pictures arrived. Now, how do I know that? Because we have, and we showed in the part of this workshop this evening, a few hours ago, I showed mission pages from actual catalogs, from, let's say, Apollo 10. There's a page where a whole series of photographs are reproduced, and most of the photographs are blank. They're blacked out. When you order those pictures, however, from the National Space Science Data Center, which is the NASA archive that is supposed to provide pictures at reasonable cost to anybody in the world who asks and wants to pay for them, The pictures are there. You can ask for them. You can order them. You can get them, and they're perfect. They're not blacked out. There's nothing wrong with them. So what we have here is a policy of censorship by discouragement. What geologist or student or space aficionado in Dubuque or Colorado or anywhere is going to order a picture from NASA that looks like it won't, you know, turn out, that it basically was taken with a lens cap on. But what you have is now obviously a pattern of what I call plausible deniability. When I led a team of eight of our specialists to a two-day, you know, intensive discussion with the folks at Goddard at the National Space Science Data Center at NASA last November, one of the things I asked them is, why are these pictures blanked out on the catalog and they're perfectly fine in your files and you can order them and there's stunning things on them? And they said, in essence, damn fino. I mean, one guy, the head of the lab, basically talked to me about printer ink and the fact that they had a bad run. What we see here is bureaucratic posterior covering, because it is a federal crime to destroy federal property.
Now, when did Apollo 10 go up? That was
May of 1969. It was the precursor test mission before the major one, which was Apollo 11.
Now, do you think that there was a general concern among this top echelon of people, this cabal, if you will? Do you think there was a concern or was an anticipated discovery when they saw whatever it was that they saw?
Well, I think they had major evidence in terms of the unmanned missions that went. In fact, part of what we're discussing this evening is the documentation now that we have, in part from some NASA sources that have leaked this to us in the last several months, that from the beginning Apollo was designed around the concept that the moon has remarkable structures on it, and Apollo was designed to go and bring the information home. And unfortunately, what I think happened is a palace coup interrupted this grand plan. The original plan, I believe, by very, high integrity people who wanted to have a chance to look at this extraordinary information themselves and assess, you know, the damage and the potential social dislocation before they made it public, that plan, I think, got derailed by a palace coup within the space agency itself. And I'm going to lay out for our people tonight when this coup occurred, what the evidence is before of agendas, what the evidence is subsequent to that coup, and how the entire space program, in essence, became hijacked almost 25 years ago, more or less now, by a small group that do not plan ever to release this information and will only release it when they are forced to by those of us outside who are closing in fast on both the data and the politics of deception.
Now, given that, okay, given that what you just said, what is the next step beyond that? If this information is now coming into your group and you're making these interesting discoveries, what happens next and where does this take us? What's the future?
Well, what we are planning, and I wanted to get this current issue of the journal, Martian Horizons, into people's hands. We have mailed to the membership. We are mailing, obviously, we may have many comp copies to members of the press who have been following our work. You know, I will make sure that you're on the list, Michael, so you get your copy.
Okay.
I strongly urge people who are interested in real data, things that stand still, to take a look at these extraordinary, stunning images, some of which we have in stereo. We have stereo pairs of these structures, some of which are 10 miles above the lunar surface.
Wow.
In the lunar grid of the Sinus Medi Dome in the dead center of the moon. By the way, there's a quarter moon out tonight. If you want to find Sinus Medi, just bisect that quarter moon, and right dead center, halfway down that quarter moon, that's where Sinus Medi and many of these structures is located.
Okay. All right. Now, Richard, what is the your lecture that you're talking about this weekend?
Well, it's more than a lecture. It's really a workshop. It's been hours and hours with breaks in between of intensive comparison of both the data, the implications, discussion of political strategies, discussion of legal moves. Remember, NASA was incorporated by an act of Congress as an open agency.
Right. It's a
Space Act, which they are not following. This creates a legal hole big enough to fly the Enterprise through.
Sure, and it's also a travesty to science.
Well, of course. But remember, we're talking political science here.
Sure.
And what I have now decided, with some legal input and expertise from other consultants, is that the way we basically tackle this is the way we have to tackle anything in this country, which is legally. We are talking about filing suit in federal district court or federal court or perhaps other courts, depending upon how things work out, where we will force NASA to come clean, or else there will be penalties under law. We've got the goods. We know they have been lying to us over and over and over again. And fortunately, some of the NASA people who are leaking are on the verge of getting the courage to stand up in front of the National Press Corps at the appropriate time and basically tell us the truth.
Well, I must applaud you for your efforts, because I think this is a real radical departure from the common idea of bashing the government and trying to force through other means that you hear people always railing about. I'm glad to hear that you're taking the proper steps to try to extract this information.
Well, what I've discovered, Michael, and this is very important for your audience to hear tonight, is that most of the people in this system are honest and wanted to do the right thing, and they have been snookered. The people who have manipulated this system, who have distorted it, who have prevented us from seeing what's there, is a very powerful minority.
You betcha.
It is not the majority.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason I know this is because more of the real folks, when they see this data, their first reaction is, oh, my God, because it is so obvious that it's real, that it's undeniable.
They feel like they've been hoodwinked.
The next step is, oh, my God, I've been snookered.
Sure. That's wild. Richard, what is the next step for your group? Where are you taking this? What's your next big thing?
Well, when I leave here, and there are real people in the other room all being super quiet. Guys, you want to say hi to your radio audience?
Sound like quite a crowd.
They've been so good. In fact, we thought we'd get into questions tonight, and they had a few, but I guess we'll have to save that for the next show.
Oh, it's an hour is just too
it is
short.
Brief to encompass this subject, which is very, very, very broad indeed.
Yes.
Anyway, when I go back, I have one day to recuperate, and then I go to Connecticut to John White's Omega Conference, and I've got Italian television, Fox television, and Canadian Discover coming down to interview, and apparently the Italian folks are doing a two-hour special of which they are planning to devote one-third to the monuments of Mars and the strange secrets of Selene and the Mars mission investigation.
Fascinating stuff.
Now, after that, we're looking at some appropriate time, a National Press Club press conference in Washington, D.C., for the Washington Press Corps, and we're going to show them stunning images. Hopefully, we will have real NASA bodies to stand up with us and ask what the hell went wrong, and then it is going to be one extraordinary free-for-all, because obviously we need to go back to the moon. We are assessing and analyzing the resources required to mount our own private unmanned mission, and we're calling it our Radio Shack mission. All right, we're talking about resources that, in fact, for under probably $1 million, can get us back into lunar orbit with live TV over CNN to show everybody what is there and what is in the wind for us.
That would be great. Now, we got real short time left. Give out your address and how people can get a hold of a copy.
If you want to join the Mars mission and as part of your membership receive the latest edition of the 80 pages on the moon from Martian Horizons, you simply send a check for $25 to the Mars mission, 122 Dodd Street, D-O-D-D, Weehawken, W-E-E-H-A-W-K-E-N, New Jersey, 07087.
And, Richard, what does it cost to join the Mars mission?
$25.
Okay, that's very very reasonable. And this is a very interesting publication. I've got a copy of here, the Martian Horizons. I encourage anyone to get a copy of this because it does have some fascinating photographs. Once again, Richard, I want to thank you very much for taking time out of your busy weekend and appearing on the program. And I want to thank your wonderful audience up there for being patient. And sorry we didn't get to the questions, but very fascinating. Thank you again.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And once again, that's Richard Hoagland, and we're talking to him. He's in Windsor, Colorado. So, please join me next week. Until then, I'm Michael Corbin telling you to keep your eyes on the skies. Good night.